Episode 2. Flatland, A Romance of Many Dimensions, by Edwin Abbott Abbott, read by David Grizzly Smith. Part 1. This World. Section 3. Concerning the inhabitants of Flatland. The greatest length or breadth of a full-grown inhabitant of Flatland may be estimated at about 11 of your inches. 12 inches may be regarded as a maximum. Our women are straight lines. Our soldiers and lowest classes of workmen are triangles with two equal sides, each about 11 inches long, and a base or third side, so short, often not exceeding half an inch, that they form at their vertices a very sharp and formidable angle. Indeed, when their bases are of the most degraded type, not more than the eighth part of an inch in size, they can hardly be distinguished from straight lines or women, so extremely pointed are their vertices. With us, as with you, these triangles are distinguished from others by being called isosceles, and by this name I shall refer to them in the following pages. Our middle class consists of equilateral or equal-sided triangles. Our professional men and gentlemen are squares, to which class I myself belong, and five-sided figures or pentagons. Next above these come the nobility, of whom there are several degrees, beginning at six-sided figures, or hexagons, and from thence rising in the number of their sides till they receive the honorable title of polygonal, or many-sided. Finally, when the number of the sides becomes so numerous, and the sides themselves so small that the figure cannot be distinguished from a circle, he is included in the circular, or priestly, order, and this is the highest class of all. It is a law of nature with us that a male child shall have one more side than his father, so that each generation shall rise, as a rule, one step in the scale of development and nobility. And thus the son of a square is a pentagon, the son of a pentagon a hexagon, and so on. But this rule applies not always to the tradesmen, and still less often to the soldiers and to the workmen, who indeed can hardly be said to deserve the name of human figures, since they have not all their sides equal. And with them, therefore, the law of nature does not hold, and the son of an isosceles, that is a triangle with two sides equal, remains isosceles still. Nevertheless, all hope is not shut out, even from the isosceles, that his posterity may ultimately rise above his degraded condition. For after a long series of military successes, or diligent and skillful labors, it is generally found that the more intelligent among the artisan and soldier classes manifest a slight increase of their third side, or base, and a shrinkage of the other two sides. Intermarriages, arranged by the priests, between the sons and daughters of these more intellectual members of the lower classes generally result in an offspring approximating still more to the type of equal-sided triangle. Rarely, in proportion to the vast number of isosceles births, is a genuine and certifiable equal-sided triangle produced from isosceles parents. What need of a certificate? A Spaceland critic may ask. Is not the procreation of a square son a certificate from nature herself, proving the equal-sidedness of the father? Well, I reply that no lady of any position will marry an uncertified triangle. A square offspring has sometimes resulted from a slightly irregular triangle, but in almost every such case the irregularity of the first generation is visited on the third, which either fails to attain the pentagonal rank, or relapses to the triangular. Such a birth requires as its antecedents not only a series of carefully arranged intermarriages, but also a long-continued exercise of frugality and self-control on the part of the would-be ancestors of the coming equilateral, and a patient, systematic, and continuous development of the isosceles intellect through many generations. The birth of a true equilateral triangle from isosceles parents is the subject of rejoicing in our country and for many furlongs around. After a strict examination conducted by the Sanitary and Social Board, the infant, if certified as regular, is with solemn ceremonial admitted into the class of equilaterals. He is then immediately taken from his proud yet sorrowing parents and adopted by some childless equilateral, who is bound by oath never to permit the child henceforth to enter his former home or so much as look upon his relations again, for fear lest the freshly developed organism may, by force of unconscious imitation, fall back again into his hereditary level. Now, the occasional emergence of an isosceles from the ranks of his serf-born ancestors is welcomed not only by the poor serfs themselves, as a gleam of light and hope shed upon the monotonous squalor of their existence, but also by the aristocracy at large. For all the higher classes are well aware that these rare phenomena, while they do little or nothing to vulgarize their own privileges, serve as a most useful barrier against revolution from below. Had the acute angled rabble been all, without exception, absolutely destitute of hope and of ambition, they might have found leaders in some of their many seditious outbreaks so able as to render their superior numbers and strength too much even for the wisdom of the circles. But a wise ordinance of nature has decreed that, in proportion to the working classes' increase in intelligence, knowledge, and all virtue, in that same portion their acute angle, which makes them physically terrible, shall increase also, and approximate to the harmless angle of the equilateral triangle. Thus, in the most brutal and formidable of the soldier class, creatures almost on level with women in their lack of intelligence, it is found that, as they wax in the mental ability necessary to employ the tremendous penetrating power to advantage, so do they wane in the power of penetration itself. How admirable is the law of compensation, and how perfect a proof of the natural fitness and, I may almost say, the divine origin of the aristocratic constitution of the states of Flatland. By a judicious use of this law of nature, the polygons and circles are almost always able to stifle sedition in its very cradle, taking advantage of the irrepressible and boundless hopefulness of the human mind. Art also comes to the aid of law and order. It is generally found possible, by a little artificial compression or expansion on the part of the state physicians, to make some of the more intelligent leaders of a rebellion perfectly regular, and to admit them at once into the privileged classes, a much larger number who are still below the standard, allured by the prospect of being ultimately ennobled, are induced to enter the state hospitals, where they are kept in honorable confinement for life. And one or two alone of the more obstinate, foolish, and hopelessly irregular are led to execution. Then the wretched rabble of the isosceles, planless and leaderless, are either transfixed without resistance by the small body of their brethren, whom the chief circle keeps in pay for emergencies of this kind, or else more often by means of jealousies and suspicions skillfully fomented among them by the circular party, they are stirred to mutual warfare and perish by one another's angles. No less than 120 rebellions are recorded in our annals, besides minor outbreaks, numbered at 235, and they have all ended thus. Section 4. Concerning the Women. If our highly pointed triangles of the soldier class are formidable, it may be readily inferred that far more formidable are our women. For if a soldier is a wedge, a woman is a needle, being, so to speak, all points, at least at the two extremities. Add to this the power of making herself practically invisible at will, and you will perceive that a female in Flatland is a creature by no means to be trifled with. But here, perhaps, some of my younger readers may ask how a woman in Flatland can make herself invisible. This ought, I think, to be apparent without any explanation. However, a few words will make it clear to the most unreflecting. Place a needle on a table. Then, with your eye on the level of the table, look at it sideways, and you will see the whole length of it. But look at it endways, and you see nothing but a point. It has become practically invisible. Just so is it with one of our women. When her side is turned toward us, we see her as a straight line. When the end containing her eye or mouth, for with us these two organs are identical, is the part that meets our eye, then we see nothing but a highly lustrous point. But when the back is presented to our view, then, being only sub-lustrous, and indeed almost as dim as an inanimate object, her hinder extremity serves her as a kind of invisible cap. The dangers to which we are exposed from our women must now be manifest to the meanest capacity in Spaceland. If even the angle of a respectable triangle in the middle class is not without its dangers, if to run against a working man involves a gash, if a collision with an officer of the military class necessitates a serious wound, if a mere touch from the vertex of a private soldier brings with it danger of death, what can it be to run against a woman, except absolute and immediate destruction? And when a woman is invisible, or visible only as a dim, sub-lustrous point, how difficult must it be, even for the most cautious, always to avoid collision? Many are the enactments made at different times in the different states of Flatland in order to minimize this peril, and in the southern and less temperate climates, where the force of gravitation is greater and human beings more liable to casual and involuntary motions, the laws concerning women are naturally much more stringent. But a general view of the code may be obtained from the following summary. 1. Every house shall have one entrance in the eastern side, for the use of females only, by which all females shall enter in a becoming and respectful manner, and not by the men's or western door. When I was in Spaceland, I understood that some of your priestly circles have in the same way a separate entrance for villagers, farmers, and teachers of board schools, that they may approach in a becoming and respectful manner. 2. No female shall walk in any public place without continually keeping up her peace cry under penalty of death. 3. Any female, duly certified to be suffering from sathitis dance, fits, chronic cold accompanied by violent sneezing, or any disease necessitating involuntary motions, shall be instantly destroyed. In some of the states there is an additional law forbidding females under penalty of death from walking or standing in any public place without moving their backs constantly from right to left so as to indicate their presence to those behind them. Others oblige a woman, when traveling, to be followed by one of her sons or servants or by her husband. Others confine women altogether to their houses except during the religious festivals. But it has been found by the wisest of our circles or statesmen that the multiplication of restrictions on females tends not only to the debilitation and diminution of the race, but also to the increase of domestic murders, to such an extent that a state loses more than it gains by a too prohibitive code. For whenever the temper of a woman is thus exasperated by confinement at home or hampering regulations abroad, they are apt to vent their spleen upon their husbands and children, and in the less temperate climes the whole male population of a village has sometimes been destroyed in 1 or 2 hours by simultaneous female outbreak. Hence, the 3 laws mentioned above suffice for the better regulated states, and may be accepted as a rough exemplification of our female code. After all, our principal safeguard is found not in legislature, but in the interests of the women themselves, for, although they can inflict instantaneous death by a retrograde movement, yet, unless they can at once disengage their stinging extremity from the struggling body of their victim, their own frail bodies are liable to be shattered. The power of fashion is also on our side. I pointed out that in some less civilized states, no female is suffered to stand in any public place without swaying her back from right to left. This practice has been universal among ladies of any pretensions to breeding in all well-governed states as far back as the memory of figures can reach. It is considered a disgrace to any state that legislation should have to enforce what ought to be, in every respectable female, a natural instinct. The rhythmical and, if I may so say, well-modulated undulation of the back in our ladies of circular rank is envied and imitated by the wife of a common equilateral, who can achieve nothing beyond a mere monotonous swing like the ticking of a pendulum. And the regular tick of the equilateral is no less admired and copied by the wife of the progressive and aspiring isosceles, in the females of whose family no back motion of any kind has become as yet a necessity of life. Hence, in every family of position and consideration, back motion is as prevalent as time itself, and the husbands and sons in those households enjoy immunity, at least from invisible attacks. Not that it must be for a moment supposed that our women are destitute of affection, but unfortunately the passion of the moment predominates in the frail sex over every other consideration. This is, of course, a necessity arising from their unfortunate conformation, for as they have no pretensions to an angle, being inferior in this respect to the very lowest of the isosceles, they are consequently wholly devoid of brain power, and have neither reflection, judgment, nor forethought, and hardly any memory. Hence, in their fits of fury, they remember no claims and recognize no distinctions. I have actually known a case where a woman has exterminated her whole household, and a half an hour afterwards, when her rage was over and the fragments swept away, has asked what has become of her husband and her children. Obviously, then, a woman is not to be irritated as long as she is in a position where she can turn round. When you have them in their apartments, which are constructed with a view to denying them that power, you can say and do what you like, for they are then wholly impotent for mischief, and will not remember a few minutes hence the incident for which they may be at this moment threatening you with death, nor the promises which you may have found it necessary to make in order to pacify their fury. On the whole, we get on pretty smoothly in our domestic relations, except in the lower strata of the military classes. There, the want of tact and discretion on the part of the husbands produces at times indescribable disasters. Relying too much on the offensive weapons of their acute angles instead of the defensive organs of good sense and sensible simulations, these reckless creatures too often neglect the prescribed construction of the women's apartments, or irritate their wives by ill-advised expressions out of doors, which they refuse immediately to retract. Moreover, a blunt and stolid regard for literal truth indisposes them to make those lavish promises by which the more judicious circle can, in a moment, pacify his consort. The result is massacre. Not, however, without its advantages, as it eliminates the more brutal and troublesome of the isosceles, and by many of our circles the destructiveness of the thinner sex is regarded as one of the many providential arrangements for suppressing redundant population and nipping revolution in the bud. Yet even in our best regulated and most approximately circular families, I cannot say that the ideal of family life is so high as with you in Spaceland. There is peace, in so far as the absence of slaughter may be called by that name, but there is necessarily little harmony of tastes or pursuits. And the cautious wisdom of the circles has ensured safety at the cost of domestic comfort. In every circular or polygonal household it has been a habit from time immemorial, and has now become a kind of instinct among the women of our higher classes, that the mothers and daughters should constantly keep their eyes and mouths towards their husband and his male friends, and for a lady in a family of distinction to turn her back upon her husband would be regarded as a kind of portent involving a loss of status. But as I shall soon show, this custom, though it has the advantage of safety, is not without its disadvantages. In the house of the working man, or respectable tradesman, where the wife is allowed to turn her back upon her husband while pursuing her household avocations, there are at least intervals of quiet, where the wife is neither seen nor heard, except for the humming sound of the continuous peace cry. But in the homes of the upper classes there is too often no peace. There the voluble mouth and bright penetrating eye are ever directed towards the master of the household, and light itself is not more persistent than the stream of feminine discourse. The tact and skill which suffice to avert a woman's sting are unequal to the task of stopping a woman's mouth. And as the wife has absolutely nothing to say, and absolutely no constraint of wit, sense, or conscience to prevent her from saying it, not a few cynics have been found to aver that they prefer the danger of the death-dealing but inaudible sting to the safe sonorousness of a woman's other end. To my readers in Spaceland, the condition of our women may seem truly deplorable, and so indeed it is. A male of the lowest type of the isosceles may look forward to some improvement of his angle, and to the ultimate elevation of the whole of his degraded caste. But no woman can entertain such hopes for her sex. Once a woman, always a woman, is a decree of nature, and the very laws of evolution seem suspended in her disfavor. Yet at least we can admire the wise prearrangement which has ordained that, as they have no hopes, so they shall have no memory to recall, no forethought to anticipate the miseries and humiliations which are at once a necessity of their existence and the basis of the constitution of Flatland. Thank you for listening to Flatland, A Romance of Many Dimensions, by A Square, written here in Spaceland by Edwin Abbott Abbott, and read by David Grizzly Smith. Music in these recordings includes Friendly Day from Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com. I do hope you'll be kind enough to comment on podiobooks.com or at grizzliesgrowls.com. And if you would, please tell others about this book, even if you are an isosceles or a woman. These recordings are released under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 3.0 license.